on the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur, because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. I hope you're having a great day out there, riding the roller coaster life of being an entrepreneur, the ups, the downs, the fun, the pain, all of it. It's rolled into the life that we have chosen to live. Oh my goodness. All right. We got a great show for you today, and appreciate you being with us, and happy holidays, whatever holiday you celebrate. They're all coming up soon. I hope you are ready to celebrate. First up today, we have Marcy Sims. Wow. Youngest female IPO ever. And it might have, I don't think it's changed since she had her IPO. I don't think any other females have come in younger, but I do think that that stat is still true. And boy, is this a cool company and an amazing story. I was blown away by how successful and how cool it was, how well thought out, and just a great, great story. After that, I have another great, great female to introduce you to, and this is sort of planned. So there's several stories going on here. Number one story is that our server that we had been on for 10 years went out of business, and they decided they just were going to close down, and they gave us warning and all of that. And yes, this is the question I get asked the most by other entrepreneurs. Yes, I considered buying it and running it myself, but didn't make sense. They were closing the business for good reason. And so all of the shows that were posted on that server died, and we had, you know, notice to download them and all that stuff, and but they're not there anymore. So we have to put them back up for you to listen to them. And number two point, some of them are just so good that we have to get them out, as in Judy Robinette. And number three, she is the great networker, and I haven't spoken to her now since COVID, I guess. And so I'm doing this so that I can have a reason to reach out to her. And sometimes we do that. We manufacture reasons so that we can reach out to people who we would like to get in touch with. I can't wait for you to hear some of Judy's stories, especially about how she got her roommate a boyfriend and then married. One of the best stories I've ever heard. It's in this interview. Thanks for being with us. We'll be back and get started in just a second. Please go buy my book on the environment. It's a great book on entrepreneurs.
Tired of talking no action on climate change? Introducing The Real Environmentalists, the bold new book by Jim Beach. It's not about activists, politicians, or professors. It's about the entrepreneurs, real risk takers, building cleaner, smarter solutions, not for applause, but for profit. The entrepreneurs in the book aren't giving speeches. They're in labs, factories, and offices, cleaning the past and building clean products for the future. The Real Environmentalists is available now, because the people saving the planet aren't the ones you think. Go to Amazon and search for Real Environmentalist. Thank you.
We are back. And again, thank you so very much for being with us. Boy, am I excited to introduce my first guest today. Please welcome Marcy Sims to the show. She is the former chair and CEO of Sims Corporation, which she took public. So her family had a clothing retail, a wholesale business selling clothing at cut rate prices. The company grew so big under Marcy's leadership that she was able to take it public on the New York Stock Exchange. There's, in our little world here, there's nothing more prestigious than that. And when doing so, she became the youngest female president in New York Stock Exchange history. For 35 years, she was on the TV. You probably saw her with her slogan, "An educated consumer is our best customer." And that respect flows through her entire company, and she built the company on respect, leading with respect. And she has got a new book out called Leading with Respect. Marcy, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hey, hi, Jim. It's so nice to be here. That was a great introduction. Thank you.
Well, you have an amazing career. Tell us about your parents.
Well, it really all started with being first generation American. My dad, who was the breakaway person who showed respect to manufacturers and convinced them to sell him below wholesale, was a first generation from parents of Russian descent who came to America in the first decade of the 1900s. They were escaping persecution in Russia. And my mother's parents came from Romania. They had a similar story of escaping the pogroms in Romania through the last decade and first decade, or the last decade of the 1800s. Anyway, they got here. They found each other. My father grew up in Brooklyn. My mom grew up in the Bronx, and they met at the beach. And my mother was a professional singer. She became, at 16, someone who did, you know, those live radio shows, Jim, you would love this, where they had a full orchestra playing while the singer sang songs. And there was an audience, just like the live TV audiences that some shows still have today on old-fashioned TV.
Interesting. What a couple of characters. And
yes,
the business. How did your father convince manufacturers to sell below wholesale?
He was a salesperson for 9 years in a small retail store that was owned by his older brother, who was 14 years his senior. He thoroughly learned the business, and I always recommend this to entrepreneurs, that you thoroughly learn the market that you intend to be a disruptor in or a contributor to. And he thoroughly learned the market of clothing manufacturing, clothing distribution. And it was a time where the market was changing because of the urban sprawl and the beginning of malls that dotted the landscape of America and real estate development. So all of a sudden, clothing manufacturers were manufacturing tons more. Really, the SKUs were increasing exponentially as department stores increased. So these manufacturers were left with a lot of overruns. They were left with returns from department stores. And during the time that my father was a salesperson, he saw this as a result of his relationships with the manufacturers. So his idea was to go to the manufacturers and say, look, I'm interested in owning and operating my own business with a new format. I'm going to buy from you below wholesale, and I'm going to sell it to the consumer. I'm not going to send anything back to you that doesn't sell, because I will take the responsibility of dealing with my consumers and selling to them. I will find the right price. And that's how he started. He had London Fog and Jockey were his first two name brands that were willing to sell him below wholesale. And there was not a moment where he was unsuccessful. The word of mouth, he opened near Wall Street, down what became One World Trade Center. Then it was a small business area before the development of the World Trade Center. And in his small store, which was only a 12-foot storefront, he was successful from the moment he opened the door.
Wow. What an amazing innovation. And the companies went along.
They did, and they grew. And as companies saw that he wasn't advertising their names, so they didn't have to worry about offending department stores by underselling them in consumer advertising. There was never, in the 55 years that we were in business, we never used the manufacturer's names. And that was key to keeping not only the trust, but the respect on what it took for a manufacturer to become a name brand, because consumers were coming in in, not just because Sims created a contract of respect with the consumer's intelligence and the respect they're spending money, their hard-earned money with us, but there was also this deep respect for what a brand name needed to do to become a brand name, how long it took, how much sacrifice, how smart you had to be, how consistent, and really, you had to be a listener. And that's one of the keys to respect, is being able to listen.
That is great advice. How did you come into the story, Marcy?
When my dad became large enough that his manufacturers, who also manufactured women's clothing, wanted him to deal with them with women's clothing, he asked me to come into the business. And I really hesitated, but being that I had worked at three other jobs before I joined Sims, and I had the experience of being fired, which, by the way, is priceless experience, even though it's a blow to your ego and self-image and all that. And there's a lot of repair that, you know, if this were a different show, we could go into. But my father asking me to join the business, the timing was perfect. And I did. And he asked me right away to represent the company in TV and radio. And I did. I also worked with him on a five-year plan on how to expand the business. We not only devised a plan, but we included in our plan the relationship with the manufacturers, understanding what they needed for us to grow, because we would not be able to grow without dealing with them. And by the way, Jim, none of this was in a contract on a piece of paper. This was all understandings between the manufacturer, designers, and our company.
No contracts at all.
No, there was contracts when we purchased things, of course, because that includes inventory and taxes and all that. But there was no written contract about what we expected from each other in terms of dealing with each other with respect, continuity, and honesty.
When did you start using the respect in terms of the customers and telling the customers that that was part of your value proposition to them?
Very early on, even before I joined the company, but very consistently through the 80s, and certainly when we went public, there was the differentiation that our corporate culture and our messaging had with other retailers was very pronounced. And this idea that an educated consumer is our best customer had to be explained. And we also had to explain what off-price was. Off-price meaning you buy below wholesale, and the price to the consumer is within 10% of the manufacturer's wholesale price. This was really before the explosion of vertical retailing, which is very pronounced today. The idea that a retailer can control all the costs in the supply chain and create a sales price to the consumer that reflects all of their costs is not what we were doing. We were dealing with manufacturers who were the supply chain for us. So we had to explain that to the consumer. And we found that an educated consumer is our best customer was a way to start that conversation. And actually explaining and having that conversation was what our company did for our marketing for the entire life of the business.
How many TV spots did you do?
Well, we created them together. I did a lot of the writing myself. I wrote a commercial with my dad that explained the automatic markdown price tag that we had on women's dresses and what we called PMs. That's more cocktail attire. And we had this automatic markdown every 30 days. It would go to final. And that meant that this was moving quickly. The consumer could see the markdowns right in front of them on the price tag. This was something that created excitement. It also reflected the fact that there were about 8 seasons in women's as opposed to the basically 2 seasons in men's clothing. We had in women's so many different items coming down from our manufacturers that there was a need for a visible markdown so that the consumer understood what our pricing was and they could make the decision when to buy. That was the first commercial that I helped write. So the line was, so you as the consumer can see when and how much each markdown will be. The other was about labels. Read labels when you buy something. Know what the fiber content is. Know what the care of the garment is. Understand if you're going to be spending money on dry cleaning or not. Today, many people don't even think of that because they're into disposable fashion. But we were trying to say to the consumer, this is an investment. We understand that you work very hard for what you make. You're separating yourself from your money. We want you to understand what it is that you're getting, and we'll help you figure that out. And we talked about sizing, that we never charged more for bigger sizes. All of this had to do with the culture of the company and the culture of respect.
Excellent. Tell us about the IPO. Why did you go public? Obviously the money cash out, but also you lose control of daddy's business.
Yes, yes. Oh, Jim, you got to the heart of the issue right away. The going public was really for my dad, for him to be able to take some chips off the table. We had been a family of always tightening our belts, as the expression went, because there was always more money that the company needed to grow, that the stores needed new flooring, or there was always a reason that there were sacrifices that were made. And I think that's part of entrepreneurship, is understanding what the trade-offs are and understanding that the investment of today is for the hopes and the work for, that will yield be the fruits of tomorrow. And that was what my dad was looking for with going public. It also was a way to professionalize the company. At that time, there were many, many more companies looking at the public market. IPOs are down about 50% from that time. And actually, the gray markets, private equity and hedge funds, etc., are much more prevalent today. They didn't even exist in the 80s to finance growth the way they do today. So going public was a way in which to professionalize. We, for the first time, we really had titles, in an entrepreneurial setting, it was just whatever you need to do. If I had to get coffee, that was fine. Someone needed coffee. There was no real fine lines, dotted lines, solid lines between work and title. It was all what needed to be done. Are you the best qualified to do it? Here, catch the ball. And that's the excitement of entrepreneurship. But because that was needed to be professionalized to get to another level, going public was a way to do that. And certainly the two investment banks that we worked with and continue to work with, and one of those investment banks actually became a board member of our public board. But you're absolutely right. At that point, you no longer are a family business. You no longer have control. And the other folks that are sitting at the table are all the shareholders and stakeholders, and you're reporting really, really changes, and your sense of responsibility to those who are owning your company really broadens and takes on new meaning.
Tell us about the book, Leading with Respect, Adventures of an Off-Price Fashion Pioneer. It's 5-star rated on Amazon. Tell us about it.
Well, I really had this need to share my father's story first and foremost. and the how he created this business model that was a disruptor in retail. It was really the first of its kind for the men's industry, for the men's clothing industry. It hadn't been done before. And it was a tribute to him for the first 60 pages. And then working with the publisher, we developed more of what happened to me as I joined the business, as I became someone who had a public face that I hadn't been really prepared for. But I did understanding the lack of women in the C-suite, that this was an opportunity. And I wanted to share that. I also wanted to share some of the experiences I had with not-for-profit entrepreneurship. And certainly there's an opportunity that hadn't been just a short time ago. And there's the opportunity also of knowing life's transitions, that being an entrepreneur doesn't always absorb the entire of your work life, that you can, after being an entrepreneur successfully and perhaps cashing out or perhaps selling in a way that you no longer have full involvement, that you have time to do something else. So I wanted to show how transitions were possible.
And how has that transition been for you, Marcy? Are you still actively involved in the business? And what are you spending your time on?
The business is now a real estate holding company. I have nothing to do with the business today. We are, as a family, myself, none of the family are shareholders today. My involvement, I became very involved with the opportunities that women have in business. I created and helped to create a organization called the Equal Rights Coalition, and now working at NYU Law School on the Equality Initiative that has to do with laws that help it be possible for women to have more teeth in the law when it comes to getting their equity.
Yes, very important.
It is. It really is. And it really makes, I had the opportunity really of a growing business right now for universities. It's for retired folks and transitioning. And I had the opportunity to go to the first program that does this at Harvard University called the Advanced Leadership Initiative. We had entrepreneurs and doctors who started their own practices and did roll-ups. And we had all kinds of people in this program the year I went. And it was all about finding your next act, because so many people with a longer lifespan were looking at maybe having, you know, solidly three or four or five opportunities to be entrepreneurs in your lifetime. It doesn't stop with your first entrepreneurship. If you get excited and you become involved in an idea and you can convince other people to join you and buy into your idea, you are an entrepreneur. And that skill, that passion, is something that can happen multiple times in your life.
Yes. That's the fun of it. And hopefully you'll do better the second and the third time.
Yes, hopefully. Oh, Jim, if you make the same mistakes. Well, it's like what Albert Einstein said, failure is success in progress. And I guess if you fail with a couple of entrepreneurial starts and you finally get to something that clicks and you've learned something along the way, the failures are all worth it.
How do I analyze whether my firm has respect now, if my employees feel respected? And then how do I become better at it over time?
Oh, that's a great question, Jim. Thank you for that. You know if your culture is a respectful one by, number one, turnover. Three, the success of your messaging. Is it sticking? And I would say the last one is, are people enjoying working with you Is there a feeling of being seen? Respect is all about being seen, being heard. And in order to accomplish that, it helps to start from the very beginning of the culture. Make sure, a couple of things. I mean, I have a list of things. I would say the cultivating respect, you have to model transparent and inclusive communications that you're not speaking down to or above. You have to honor people's time and their contributions. Make sure that you're not just recognizing numbers, that you're recognizing the people that accomplish those numbers. Make accountability mutual, not just hierarchical. Don't take ownership of successes. Share failures. You have to address disrespect swiftly and systematically. People in your business have to understand that there are processes for dealing with disrespect so that people can anticipate. And you have to recognize people who are outstanding at communicating respect, who work in the organization. That's how you build it.
All right. How do I ask if I am being respectful? If turnover, that's one way, but it seems like that would be a long-term measure, not a short-term measure.
Well, you can also see that in your hiring practices, because you do have the opportunity as you go through hiring practices. And we established some very, I think, unique ways in which at a certain level that we would do hiring and training. Training is an important part of respect. When we hired someone to be on the sales floor, and this started when we were a smaller company, we would allow people to have an exposure to all the jobs in the store. They would, over a 30-day period, you would get to do all the jobs, including sweeping the floor. Everyone had a taste of what it took to get that door open in the morning. And then they would find out what they particularly were good at, they had an affinity for. And usually what we were able to do was let them do the job that they had the affinity for. That didn't mean that's where they stayed. So really respect starts with the hiring process and the training process. When we were doing management training, there was an opportunity for feedback so that someone who was being trained could tell us this worked, this didn't work, what I learned my previous jobs that might help expand our understanding of training. There was always a dialogue, and that you can tell. You can tell if you're having a dialogue. Is your culture expansive, or is it very focused, limited in a way that eventually will strangle it and will stop your business from growing?
Yes. Very true. Yep. Marcy, we're about out of time. What final thought do you have to share with us?
Oh, well, maybe I'll share something that my dad used to say all the time. He said, don't let the bad guys win. Actually, he used the word bastards. Don't let the bastards win. And so it's probably a good idea to also, on a darker note, to identify that which you are overcoming. And what we identified was we were overcoming the culture of buyer beware. And we wanted to be the forerunners of buyers need to know everything we know in order to make a good decision. And so it's sometimes important to identify that as you create your company and you make a niche for yourself in the marketplace.
How do we find out more, follow you online, get a copy of the book?
Well, you can certainly go to your local bookstore and ask for Leading with Respect by Marcy Sims. I'm all for small business. Of course, it's on Amazon, and it's also on audiobooks with me reading it.
Ah, fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you so very much for being with us, and congratulations on the book. I hope it sells well for the holiday season. And
well, it's
story,
a great
Marcy. Thanks for sharing. Just a great story.
Thank you. It is an inspirational book. So for those in our lives that need some inspiration to get it done, I recommend it. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Marcy. And we will be right back.
Well, that's a wonderful question, actually, Jim.
Oh my gosh, I love the opportunity to do this. Thank you, Jim.
Wow, that's a great one.
You know, that is a phenomenal question.
That's a great question, and I don't have a great answer.
That's a great question.
Oh, that is such a loaded question, and that's actually a really good question.
School for Startups Radio.
And welcome back to the show again. Thank you so very much for being with us. I am really excited to welcome to the show today a return guest. She was with us about 4 years ago. Her name is Judy Robinette. She is the startup funding guru expert as a very popular speaker and has a new book out called Crack the Funding Code, How Investors Think and What They Need to Hear to Fund Your Startup. She has been on some of the most important boards and really cool positions of responsibility with companies that you're going to be impressed with. For example, she was on the advisory board of Luminate Venture Capital. You should have heard of them. Menlo Park Ventures, also was a partner at Crowdfund Capital Advisor, former managing director of Golden Seeds Angel Investment Firm, also a faculty member at Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Business, and an advisor to an upcoming movie. Her first book, I think it was her first book, came out 4 or 5 years ago called How to Be a Power Connector, the 10-50-150 Rule, and it won Business Book of the Year by Inc. Magazine. She has been featured. We're going to torture her. She has been featured in Forbes, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, a bunch of places like that. And I'm really excited to welcome her back. I think, Judy, that the first interview you and I did was your first interview for your book tour. I think I took your radio virginity. Welcome to the show.
You did. Thank you so much, Jim. Delighted to be back here with you.
I am so excited to talk. We haven't caught up in a while. Congratulations on the new book. Before we talk about that, I love your message about networking, and one of your stories sticks out to me still to this day. I think I've retold it many times. Tell me if you remember the story about your college roommate couldn't get a date, the advice you gave her, what happened, and how that turned into your networking philosophy.
Yes. So my college roommate, Margaret, was pretty shy. And she kept complaining to me that she didn't think anybody would ever ask her out. So I gave her the task that she had to talk to, 4 to 5 strangers, just say hi during the day on campus. And sure enough, she ended up with several dates. And within that year, she was married.
I mean, it's sometimes in the networking space, it's just taking the initiative to say hi to somebody, and that starts, doesn't it?
Absolutely. So, research shows we only talk to strangers 2% of the time. And it's really sad. Most of us didn't know our spouses. They were at one point strangers. And I tell people, if you develop this skill, and the way to do it is to either offer a heartfelt compliment or to ask a question. And I've never had anybody be nasty to me when I've done this. Of course, I don't, bother people if they're sleeping on the plane. But it has, I've met billionaires who were taking hikes in Park City. So it's an important skill to learn to talk to strangers.
And in terms of networking, going to that chamber event, there's always someone standing there by themselves who doesn't know what to do, who would desperately appreciate you going up and shaking their hand.
Absolutely. Just put your hand out, say, hi, I'm Jim, I'm Judy. I'm excited to be here today. And it's amazing if you can take the focus off of yourself and put it on the other person. And actually, introverts often are better than extroverts because they know how to listen. And you never know who you're standing by or the connections they may have. And I'll give you an example. Last week I was in New York doing a couple of TV shows, but I was asked to speak at a Black Women in Tech conference. And I did. And in the speaker room was a lady, and I just, you know, started talking to her a little bit. She just introduced me to two really high-end media contacts. And so you never know. And it's to your advantage to reach out to strangers.
And I am an introvert, Judy, but I have found that in these situations where I am awkward, right, when I'm uncomfortable, like a chamber event or something like that, that's not where, you know, the room I'm naturally comfortable in. It's easier if I do go up and initiate a conversation than standing there by myself. I'm more comfortable having a bad conversation than being by myself, because then I feel awkward and, you know, everyone's looking at me and everyone knows that no one will talk to me, Judy. No one will talk to me. Yeah. Everyone knows it. And that's what everyone's talking about. Hell, no one's even noticed.
And my fear was, why would anybody want to talk to me?
Yeah.
And so a trick you can do is, you know, go to the chamber a little early and talk to the organizers by name. You know, tell them what you're doing and ask them to introduce you to a couple of key people. Another trick is to take somebody who's been there before and have them. You can be their wingman. That works really well, too.
All great advice. Judy, let's move on to the new book, 5-star rated with almost 55-star reviews on that Amazon place, Crack the Funding Code: How Investors Think and What They Need to Hear. That's a really interesting way of talking about this. It's almost like we're going to tailor our business pitch just for the investor.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, I had to write this book, Jim, because I was so frustrated meeting great founders who just couldn't figure out how to get funded. And of course, those angels and VCs and family offices can be pretty opaque. And I've been an angel investor. I sit on VC boards, advise some incubators. And so I kind of learned, as Einstein said, if you're going to play the game, you'd better know the rules. And the first one is that you position yourself as a high potential startup by being really clear on your exit, because those investors want their money back and an ROI. And the second is to mitigate risk as viewed by the investor. So often what you see is during a pitch, someone will come in and go, geez, I've got just the greatest Kool-Aid here. And, you know, they're drinking their Kool-Aid, they're showering in their Kool-Aid. And the investors really want to focus on how you're going to grow a successful business.
All right, so let's dive into exit first, Judy. I agree 100%, of course, with what you're saying. There's no way I could disagree. But how do I work that in without it seeming like, well, number one, my fear would be I'm already thinking about the big payday at the end and they're not going to like that. And they're thinking that my attention might be somehow distracted, or, you know, I just won't be focusing on building the real business. I'll be trying to, you know, do that 2000 thing where we sell the fake business on vaporware, right? On what we plan to do. Talk to me about how to present all of that without coming across poorly.
Well, you know, if you understand that angels typically want their money back in 5 years, in your go-to-market strategy, you can have how you're going to scale the company, all of that information, and then say that you're looking at potential acquirers at year 5. And this will be music to the investors' ears. And 95% of exits are indeed strategic sales. The average exit, $65 million. That would make you or I happy, wouldn't it, Jim?
Oh, yeah. Sign me up. I'll sign up.
And so you can find comparables. So my favorite two places are CB Insights and The Pitch Book. Both of those are free resources. You can Google and you can find out what the comparables are for the exits. You can also find out who's investing, what VCs, what angel groups are investing in your specific sector.
All right. That is some great advice, everybody. I hope you got that. We will put that up on the show notes for you. CB Insights and PitchBook, right, Judy? Did I get both of those correct?
Yes, CB Insights.
Okay, great.
I'll send you a couple of their reports.
Okay, and I'll make sure they're up for all of the listeners. So we have a 15-slide pitch deck, and slide number 15 is my contact information, and slide number 14 is the timeline and shows the four or five things I've done to reduce risk. We'll come back to that in a second. And also shows where I am now, and then says blatantly at the bottom of slide 14 at the bottom, in 5 years, we are going to look for acquisition and possible exits. That forward, right, Judy? Am I okay?
Yeah, absolutely. And any strategic partnerships you're planning to do. So one of the wisest moves to find funding is to find a corporate venture capital group that is in your industry. And it's just amazing. There's more of these than there are regular VCs. And the money they're investing is, I think recently I read $28 billion. It's up considerably. It's not up as, you know, the total VC amount that was invested is $100 billion. And so the numbers are looking really good. But any strategic partnership that you have, anything to grow sales, that's really important to them. So if you've done your homework, and you've looked at comparables of three other companies that have sold for them to have. And you don't even have to have it on the slide. You can just talk to it as you're talking through your story. Or when you initially meet with the investors, you can tell them, because often they will want to know what your plan is. And it's really smart to have developed the relationship. You know, people have got to know you, like you, and trust you to fund you. But of importance is, before those people invest, you want to have an agreement on what kind of exit you're looking on. There's probably been more breakups and litigation over the exit than you can imagine. So that's an important one to have developed up front. What's your vision, how you're going to scale, and what you're looking to do for the future of your company.
All right, so how about this? As I wrap up here, the final minute of the presentation, you see that we are looking at possibly being acquired in year 4 or 5, and we will actively pursue that. Just coincidentally, three companies that are in a space very similar to us have been acquired in the last year, Miss Robinette, and one of them Katerra went for $100 million, and so we see a very strong potential in our space. Now, final slide here is my contact info, blah, blah, blah. Do you like that?
Excellent, Jim. That would be absolutely exceptional.
Okay. Just whip it out. Go ahead and say, one of our sort of competitors got bought and we are too.
Okay. Yep. Absolutely.
All right. Let's move on to your other suggestion that we did a couple minutes ago, decrease risk. Right. So talk to me about this a little bit.
Yeah. So often I will meet founders and they've never done a startup before. And that causes a little bit of angst oftentimes with investors. So, you know, if you look at the lean model that you have, the one pager that shows you there's a value proposition with a bow around it, I tell people to put the prettiest bow they can. And one of the ways to do that is to bring on two or three powerful advisory board members. And then people will look and go, oh my gosh, if this person is in on this deal, this is a good deal. So I've helped bring on, you know, for instance, a director from Microsoft, a past CFO from PayPal, and you have top quality people, then that helps them mitigate the risk. And, you know, they often talk about this group needs adult supervision. And that's one way to provide that, is to show them that you have very credible, powerful people that you're going to listen to. So, you know, one of the ways to not get funded is not be perceived as coachable. So if you're an arrogant know-it-all, you'll get booted out of the room very quickly.
All right. I'm thinking about some businesses right now, Judy, that have this quote unquote adult supervision. And I find that the adults are sometimes even more incompetent than the people they're supervising. But for example, Facebook, I've written posts about this on LinkedIn. about how I think that the adult supervision horribly failed there, if not providing better education for Zuckerberg and oversight and addressing some of these issues in advance. So anyway, you said adult supervision, so
absolutely.
I just went off on that.
I mean, absolutely. You want to do your due diligence and make sure that the people really will add value and that there's a good character chemistry fit. You know, Oprah says when someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time. So you only want people that are committed to your business, and they'll have your future and they'll have your back.
All right. What about partnerships, that kind of things? We have a marketing deal with this company. They're going to do blah, blah, blah for me, right? Is that another good way to reduce risk in eyes of the investors? Do they give that kind of stuff much credence?
Yes. Oh, yeah. So Paul Graham, who's the co-founder of Y Combinator, says there's only two reasons that a startup fails. The first is lack of a customer. The second is lack of funding. And so if you have any partnerships, anything like that, you're golden because you've proven the dog's going to eat the dog food, as they say in the VC world. You know, I meet a lot of people and they think they've got this brilliant idea and maybe their friends and family will buy it, but nobody else will open their wallet. And at that point, you have a hobby.
Again, we are speaking with Judy Robinette about her new book, Crack the Funding Code, How Investors Think and What They Need to Hear to Fund Your Startup. So we've been going through some suggestions and we were focusing on reducing risk. I also know that in the book, Judy, you introduce your three C's that investors want. What are these?
Yeah, so the first one is be coachable. You know, I mentioned this briefly, that if you're an arrogant know-it-all, nobody's going to give you their money. They worry what you'll do with their money. You won't listen to them. And this isn't a deal where they fund you, forget you. So it's important that you're viewed as coachable. So angel investors in particular have often had exits themselves as entrepreneurs. And so they want to coach. I mean, they would like to be involved in mentor because they want it to be successful for everybody. The second one is your character. And Howard Stevenson, who's known as the godfather of entrepreneurism at Harvard, wrote a book teaching people how to invest. And he advised them that the first time they heard an exaggeration, a white lie, to run, not walk, because you would also lose your money. And the third one is a level of confidence, because people worry if you're not confident, how are you going to sell? And so important to be a little confident. And I'll give you some advice on this. When I was CEO of a public company, I walked around the house for a couple of months going, I can't be the CEO of a public company. And my PR guy, who'd come out of a big firm, was asked to do a training video. And he liked the acting so well, he got an agent, but he got turned down all the time. And his agent sent him to a character actor. And this guy made him walk around the room for 5 minutes, morning and night, and say out loud, I am perfect for the part. And it actually worked. It helped me, and it will help you as well. And then realize that, you know, everybody in that room knows you're broke, and your problem is their solution. So the one thing they lose sleep over is finding a good deal. So change that equation in your head. You actually solve their problem.
Great advice. How do I let you know that I'm coachable? Is it as simple as when you say something, like you reflect on slide number 12 or the answer to my question, and I go, that's great advice. I appreciate that. I will remember that, and I'm going to try to address that situation. Have I just demonstrated
coaching?
Absolutely. Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
It's not that hard. That one's easy.
Yeah, and you can also ask a question of them. You know, we're considering, and this could be further on in a conversation or earlier, but you could say, you know, we're considering three paths here on scaling. What has been your experience?
All right. The quote from the Harvard business professor, that's a scary quote. If you get the faintest sense of exaggeration or white lie, run, because as an entrepreneur, I'm certainly going to paint the prettiest picture I can. you know, and that's not going to be a white lie or an exaggeration, but a lot of business plans that I've seen would be what I consider exaggeration. I mean, you know, we're going to get 42% market share in 5 years, Judy.
Well, you know, there's some things that become really obvious. So I've often sat through pitch events and I'll hear, we have no competition. Well, frankly, if you have no competition, there's no market. Or we're going to get 0.5% of the money in China, and next year our company will be valued at $1 billion. You know, those kind of things show you have not done your homework. And so, you know, those are kind of serious exaggerations. Now, it's always good to work with someone. The guy that I recommend on financial performance is David Meister out of New York, who will come up with very realistic performance. And it's okay to be forward-looking, but you've got to, as Jack Welch said, get better reality. You can't say you're going to have a valuation 3 times that of Facebook or your revenues are going to be bigger. And so those are the things that you certainly can be positive and forward-looking. There's nothing wrong with that.
All right. What do I need to do if I'm in a space, for example, podcasting? We all understand that it is, quote unquote, the future. I don't know what it is. The future of what? I don't know. Right. And,
yep.
But we certainly are. It certainly is going to be something that people are raising money in that space, right? For various things. I'm starting to see podcasting business plans and things. Not for a show, but for as an industry, part of the whole infrastructure, for example. How do I present that to a venture capitalist or just an angel when we don't really know what the industry is going to look like yet?
Yeah, so often, and Clayton Christian talks about this, if you're disruptive, you're the new person, the new kid on the block, it is hard to figure out what that market space might be. And the advice that I often give is look at something that could be comparable and look at those rates. And often, if you've got an idea, there's other people out there that have got the idea. So go Google and find out something that's either similar or close to, and that will often help you come up with something that's reality-based.
All right. I like that example. That makes a lot of sense. Judy, what's your final thought? We're about out of time. Give us one more nugget, something that we haven't mentioned. What did I not ask you?
So you didn't really ask me about, you know, some of the investing things. And I'll tell you, there's no lack of money. There's $279 trillion of private global wealth, 300 angel groups in the United States, equally from north, south, west, and east. And we're seeing more and more family offices. Family offices now are having better deal flow than the VCs. So no lack of money out there. It's important to be persistent. Go to pitch events, go to incubators, entrepreneurial programs, certainly talk to the SBA, the SBDC, and SCORE. They all have relationships with investors. And then ask what I call my two golden questions. You meet somebody, you're telling them about your startup. Question one, what other ideas do you have for me? And question two, who else do you know I should talk to? You'll be amazed. Your dentist probably knows investors. So be persistent. Ask for help.
You know, I had one guest whose entire philosophy of raising money is go to people who've never invested before in something like this, like the dentist, and that they're easy targets. And usually they know stuff and know people. So very good. Judy, I am so glad to get caught up with you and to spend some time with you. You are absolutely just the very best. How do you want people to find out more, get in touch with you, follow you online, and get a copy of the book?
So feel free to reach out to me at judy@judyrobinette.com with no E on the end. You can find my book on Amazon. I'm really thrilled that it's an international bestseller. And I'm on, you know, LinkedIn, I tweet. So reach out, I'm happy to help.
Thank you so very much. Congratulations on the book, and we'll talk again soon. Thanks a lot, Judy.
Thank you, Jim.
We are out of time, but we come back tomorrow. Be safe. Take care. Bye now.